basement, sitting pretty little policemen in a row. See how they fly like Lucy in the sky, see how they run.
Periander, Part 3. In the original text, the shorthand of the census taker was interrupted by regular cursive, where he described intervals in events before continuation of the interview, alternating then from the transliteration of the shorthand to these other portions in the notes. One finds portions of trivial diary of the census taker. Here, for example, beneath the annotated date, 3 July, he reported that he attended to his toilet and laundry in the morning, wrote a letter to his mother, posted a card for a girl named Gladys, then settled his accounts for room and board, $3.50 payable to Mrs. Miller, before he returned to the soldier's home. Such details make him palpable to one holding his shoebox and reading these notes. The notes resume their cryptic cipher as he resumes his interview, setting the impressionistic scene as he had on the first day, saying that he found the old soldier waiting for him at the stone balcony in the rear of the home as before. Set out by the matron, again to face the trees in one of the Adirondack chairs where he and other old soldiers sat. Another windless hot day, before the screen of oak trees on the edge of the bluff overlooking the Mississippi. The census taker's narrative continues. Return to the subject of Jackson's inauguration, as if we had not parted for more time than it takes to draw a breath. He said that after the president had read his speech, a marshal presented the Bible to him. The president took it from his hands. He pressed his lips to it and laid it reverently down. Then the chief justice administered the oath to him. When he finished, he faced the crowd below the portico and bowed as he declared his obeisance to the majesty of the people. Cannon were lit just then from the heights, from the southern hills across the Potomac, beyond the city, booming, round after round, billowing gun smoke over the river. And though shot from some distance resounded so thunderously about the swampy basin of the city that the ground trembled on which Major stood. Standing right beside him was Francis Scott Key himself, who exclaimed in soprano his thrilled excitement, "How grand, how sublime!" he lisped, and dabbed at his dewy eyes with generous lace that overflowed his sleeve. The ship cable, which had been set up makeshift to hold back the folk, broke down, and all rushed up the steps, all eager to shake their hands with him, the president of We the People. It was only by a surrounding defense, a body of men, the major his own self included with the soldiery, and the many aides of the new president, that he got away before stampede overcame him, and he was striding to his mount, a splendid white stallion, where it stood out alone at the bottom of the Capitol Hill and the park that opened up at the head of Pennsylvania Avenue. He had to pull up his mount manfully as it stamped and reared in rampant agitation, and it would have trampled those nearby spectators had Jackson not controlled it so well. He was so surrounded by the onrushing sea of people that for a moment he was stopped. The living mass was impenetrable, but it burst with a cheer, and a passage opened forcibly by Major and others with shouts and imprecations. The president's white horse pranced out onto the central boulevard, shops bedecked with bunting, festooned with flags, where the parade now gathered instantly behind him, and where before him The people ran up its corridor to get places to see him pass, cheering people. Collected 7 or 8 deep, mostly men, but women too, toddlers on men's shoulders, children running if escaped from maternal restraint. The president waved his hat at them while his horse frisked, and a cortege of many cannon caissons ordered up smartly to accompany his victory march to the White House. Ranks of uniformed marching men fell in evenly behind those, and uniformed cavalry mustered long rows behind these. Erupting out of this enthusiasm, one of his former Indian killers, a spry old hick, quick as a cat, stepped out in front beside the president and brandished a tattered Old Glory from the wars. The would-be flag-bearer, costumed in his native buckskins and a fur cap. The major knew him from home himself. He capered before the parade, shouting gladly as he went. Behind the soldiery, the audience from the Capitol gathered, and collapsing into those masses also from all sides of the boulevard, the lines of spectators joined into the massive parade. A parade of the people, splendid or homespun as they were. Farmers, tradesmen, and gentlemen too, folk from back home, and admirers from everywhere, mixing with the locals, and even the niggers, them what's freed with the slaves too. Boys on the inside edges darted about or between legs, or pretending to be soldiers, marched alongside soldiers. And women who dared held up babes in arms to witness this monument, imperiled by the crush of it. Carriages, elegantly upholstered sedans alongside common wagons and spindly mule carts, followed all this sea of people and bore him up in egalitarian celebration to his new house. On the approach, they found the entrance to the White House already too impossible, gummed up like a cider press, and saw the whole of the avenue in the front yard was full up, brimming, and stuffed with too many human beings, all types, and scampering dogs too. The White House staff had been reckoning this for many days while working on the quiet, because John Quincy Adams and his family were staying out of sight before the inauguration. Everything had got complicated by the animosities between the former and the new presidents. Jackson, who was staying at Gadsby's hotel nearby, refused to communicate with the outgoing president. He believed Adams' viperous electioneering had caused his wife's premature death. He hated him for that, and his passionate grief had made him wrathfully melancholic. It was feared that should the two men meet, Adams would have lost his life at an utterance to Jackson. So they were kept apart. No police or militia was called, and so in a trice the White House itself was swarmed over by this multitude, very like it had been stormed by the enemy that night in 1812, taken by overwhelming assault from all sides at once. A great crowd had been expected, but not the mob of this enormity. A perfect maelstrom of mankind it looked, a carnival in Hades, thrashing like it were the massive mess of many wrestling giant octopi, all tentacles and slither. Major grinned to see how they mobbed through every door to the White House. By the hundreds, by thousands, they inundated the grounds and pressed indoors, one uninterrupted stream of muddy, filthy, rude traffic. Well, what do you think you would do? The majesty of the people was now just a rabble of men and boys, niggers and women and children, all scrambling, fighting, and romping, and carping like loud hounds at a coon hunt. It was the people's day, the people's president, the people rule. Ice creams and cake and lemonade had been laid out in the parlor, huge quantities of lemonade. And orange punch had been set up on tables, all liberally laced with strong whiskey. No finery of crystal punch bowls could serve a crowd like this. Even hogsheads would not be sufficient to serve so many. So they had the punch poured into big wash tubs and put into dozens of watering buckets, and the people just helped themselves by any cup or container they could find and scooped up all the free liquor they could or wanted. Celebrants got drunk quick. Jackson supporters raucous and fueled up by the liquor packed into all the rooms on the first floor of the mansion, broke the fancy French furniture by use as well as abuse, it being such puny stuff, and smashed or kicked about the china cups and crystal goblets that they dropped when emptied. Men with muddy boots befouled whatever they trod upon, and to get a gander at the president, many got up on top of upholstered chairs and sofas, or scrabbling over desks and tables for some advantage, scuffed and marred the fine inlaid veneer. Windows got thrown open to relieve the torrent of milling people to give outlet, for too many were entering the doors that could go out that way. Ladies fainted. Men got bloody noses. A dog took a shit on the carpet, and that was stepped in. In one corner, a black bitch, sitting by herself, was eaten from out of one of the president's embossed conserve bowls. Eaten the jelly out of it with one of his gold spoons. "It's a free country," she sneered at the aide who tried to chase her away, taking with her what she had got hold of and would not give up. So the people took their drinks and their souvenirs with them as they squeezed back out onto the lawn or poured out the windows, while the outside mob, for its part, tried to squeeze into the mansion through the doors, and now scrambling in through the open windows, to get their own deserved share of drinks and souvenirs. The crush inside got so great it might have proved fatal to the crowd or to the president himself. At one point, the president, who had retreated until he was pressed up hard against the wall, was only secured by the major and a barrier of other friends and aides around him, pushing back violently against the crowd. The pressure got so great they were afraid his admirers could have pushed the president down to the floor and suffocated him. Seeing the president crushed against the wall and gasping for air, Major and several others at last dragged him from the room backwards out of a window and crossed the thronging street with him to safe rooms at Gadsby's. Altogether, 20,000 of the majesty of the people, maybe 30,000, maybe more, passed through the executive mansion that day, attacking the refreshments, breaking china and glassware, standing in muddy boots on damask-covered chairs, ripping down drapery, trampling on rugs, and breaking costly handmade French furniture, taking away silver service, oil, portraitures, and miscellaneous mementos. The food quickly ran out, but whiskey punch kept flowing. To draw the crowds outside, the White House steward at last had the servants drag the wash tubs of whiskey punch out onto the White House lawn and put buckets out at the gate like they were watering cattle. At what time the punch finally ran out, Major did not know. He had gone to sleep off his own drunk. But there were plenty of slumbering or staggering drunks on the lawn for well into the next afternoon, and even late, when he finally got himself up and departed the city to return to his home in Kentucky.
Your knickers down. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggmen.
was determined when he got back home to create his own empire of lands, to put out the Indians that were in his way according to the feelings of the people, and generally to take what he needed and wanted. But as if his intentions were known to those Indians when he got back home, he was told that they had come and killed his second wife in his absence. He wished rather they'd killed the first, and that got him to argue with her and rail at her, and the boys too, because they had not kept a watch. Now, it had happened she was alone because she was wanting to be alone. But that was because his first wife beleaguered her so bad, chewing on her with her bitch bites and snarling at her all the time and not giving her no dinner nor lunch and generally making misery her only meal. So she left for one of the other places, and so he found her and saw that they had done as bad a thing to her as been done to them by Jackson and Major before time. And then some things worse. When he found her, the talisman told him what to do. Right after he had buried all of her that he could find and burned the place because there was some he could not find. He went back home and sat at the table and said, "Woman, make your man some supper." And his wife set herself on her three-legged stool, the same her dead mama had given her for her regrettable trousseau, and fussed at her stew. But that stool began to be something that he just could not stand to look at. And the ways she sat on it, with her fat ass hanging over it. So he pushed at her with his foot, pushed her right off the stool. She got back up on it, but he pushed her off again. They did this again and again, and finally she cursed and tried holding on to it, but he got up and struck her with his fist. The boys watched all this. He struck her again, pushed her off that stool, and picked up that stool and struck her with that stool, and it killed her. That was his defense when they tried him the next week. "The stool killed her," said he. The boys telling what they saw, but one saying that his daddy done it on purpose, and the other saying it was not a sure thing. He was found out to be guilty and looked to be hanged, but no one wanted to do it. Many men did not like his wife when she was alive, but their own wives told them to do what was right. It could be any wife, they said. It was just wrong what he'd done. But it was somehow the night before he was to be hanged that they all had been drinking whiskey with him in the barn where he had been kept, and they fell asleep and left the door open and unwatched, so he got away. Misery and mankind. "Mankind is brutes," he said to me, and Matron interrupted him. He looked up at her when Matron offered us sandwiches and a drink of lemonade. He was taken to use the facilities with her assistance, while I ate a sandwich and waited. It was intolerable hot, windless still. When he came back, he began again without a prompt, but he seemed to digress on some thought that must have preoccupied him in the interruption. I did not understand immediately its relevance. "The talisman tells me all things are nothing to me. Neither God nor any human being concern themselves with anything but themselves. Likewise, I concern myself neither with God nor with any human being, nor any living creature for that matter. And what are the dead to me? I am not more to God than any other creature, dead or alive, is to me. Therefore, they are nothing to me. So far as that goes, I'm no more than a stone in the universe, and so everything in the universe is just stone to me. You have heard that nothing comes of nothing, But I tell you that I am unique. I myself am creative nothingness, because out of me everything comes so far as I'm concerned. And nothing matters except what concerns me. What's good? What's bad? Why, what is good or bad for me, and nothing else. I myself am neither good nor bad. Neither has any meaning to me. I do not care what is true, good, just, free, etc., except for what is mine. Nothing is more to me than myself. He stopped speaking, and I saw that he had an expression of some awful pain, had shut his eyes, which were teary, and I looked up and around to summon Matron, but he opened his eyes before I could locate her, and sighed, blinking, and shook his head, and said something not quite audible. I put my hand on his, and he nodded, and then continued to tell his tale. Pain to one and all, nothing to be done about it, that's that. So, Major went on downriver, and then up another as he run off, and across another, and into lands which belonged to Indians who had left the lands he had taken from them before. Lands they had taken, lands that had ruins on them, great earthen mounds large as temples, towering temples, temples piled on temples like mountains. For so long had ancient peoples built these temples upon temples and ruined them, or died away and forgot them to the wilderness where they were overgrown and fallen down into the earth, then rebuilt, topped them again. So many times had this occurred that in some of these places the mounds were pyramids that rose to heights 10 or 12 times over. Was this sacred to repeat it, or was it rapacious? But certain no one knew what these were and whence they came. And though the Indians deemed them holy and solemnly revered them like good Catholics do their relics, they had no art to make one. They had no memory of their use. They were just so many burial grounds to them. And what good are the dead to us? Are not the dead just surrounding us anyway? What ground is not the mold of man? Of course, he tore them down, partly to gain from them their sod, and partly for curiosity of what was found inside, which he always destroyed as well, and partly because he got satisfaction from that destruction and the way it aroused the despair of the Indians. He had, by this time, a big gang of followers, men like he who hated men, detested women, drank much, brawled, lived life full up to the top, more than they do today, who knew what it was really like to be free, and had come to these places because you could take a living out of naked opportunity, fur trappers, renegades, scouts, scalpers, river pigs. So, when the Indian attacked or defended what they had from his attack, he always and brutally defeated them. He went and got himself another place, and another, and then some more, and pretty soon he was like a boss to everybody all around, and there was nothing nobody could get or do or go to without his say-so. And the town that grew up there, before there was no state, before there was elections and all that, was his town, and he made the law. He made the law, like Moses, by God. He was Moses. He got himself many wives, like old Moses, and one wife was a heathen, just like Moses had. No one could live in his town without his permission. He kept a bodyguard. He held this law in his town: correct not only offenders, but those who are thinking to offend. Yes, sir. Soon, He had a whole kingdom all to himself, a kingdom to which he was both sovereign and holy father. And he founded there his religion of his own self, that is, his belief that all are inferior to him as he holds it. Yet he had no children, except those two boys who he had had by that wife he had killed. And while he loathed the son who testified against him and considered him an enemy, he still loved the son who had not. He wanted his son to inherit what he had created. He wanted this son to be king after his death. He therefore sent a messenger to his sons to join him. The old soldier now sat up with difficulty to pull himself up by the arms of the Adirondack chair, and edged out on the seat of it and perched there, leaned toward me and looked intensely at me and said, "I am that messenger. I went up river like he told me to do. I told his sons about the kingdom and that they should come. But the son that had betrayed him, he was suspicious, as he rightly ought to be. And he protested what I said and told his brother that they should not come, but probably ought to get a warrant out for their father's arrest. And so I killed him. And his brother tried to defend him and kill me, so I had to kill him too. When I got back and told him what I'd done, he said nothing to me at first and did nothing for a time but sit by his lonesome, and I thought this is not like him, and I calculated what maybe should be done. He wasn't eating, but just drinking whiskey all day long. They was going to do him harm for sure if they saw him weak that way, I told him. And he stopped drinking then, but made up his mind. Matron came, end of the day again. I was amazed so much time had gone by, but I saw that the sunlight had gone golden on the tops of the trees where the setting sun had put its gleam. And I realized I had not ate but a sandwich all day. He got up to go with some struggling to stand. I helped him. He thanked me.